Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. It once again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Well, good evening. My name is Penelope Bennett, and I wish to welcome you on this 31st of March, the last day of March, 2021. This is the Stop Child Abuse Now Talk radio show, sponsored by NASCA, which stands for the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. As I stated, my name is Penelope Bennett. I am from Bellevue, Washington, and tonight, Wednesday night, is special guest night, meaning that we have a very special guest this evening to tell their story. Our special guest, his name is John Michael Lander. He is from Kettering, Ohio. And before I tell you a little bit more about John and a little bit about his bio, which he very generously gave to a producer so that we could have a little bit more background on him. But before I give you a little bit more information on John, I want to talk to you and tell you about NASCA and NASCA's mission. So the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse Trauma Prevention, Intervention, and Recovery. We have a single purpose at NASCA. It's to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so with only two goals. The first, educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone. The second, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse, and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. If you're streaming the show and you'd like to call in and join our panel, you are welcome to do so at any time during the show. It is a 90-minute show. We welcome your call. The number to call in is area code 646-595-2118. Again, that's area code 646-595-2118. NASCA's mission and goals, information for anyone who wishes to learn more about the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse can go to our website, which is www.nasca.org. So here's how the show works on special guest night. We have 90 minutes, which actually goes by very, very quickly, and I like to break the show. We like to break the show into three segments. We'll introduce our special guest and give you a little background on John Lander this evening. And in the first segment, so the first third, we'll ask John some questions around his childhood from the ages of his earliest memory till about 15, 16. Then we'll break to our panel, who will have an opportunity to ask John a question or may have a comment. Again, this is John's special night in his story, so we do ask that the questions and comments be around John and his story that he's sharing with us. Then the second segment, we'll go back to John, and it's usually in the middle years from about 15, 16 to 30 or 35, and we'll break to the panel again if we have time. And the last segment will be what John is doing today currently in his current life. So this is normally how the show works. We are fluid in the fact that sometimes we run out of time or topics come up from our guests, and that is perfectly fine. So I wanted to give you a little bit of background how the show is run. So before I bring on our very special guest, John, I do want to mention that we have a NASCA family member from Ontario, Canada, Peter. NASCA is an international organization, so sometimes we have many different continents and countries represented on our panel. And so we are pleased to have Peter from Ontario, Canada. And we have Bill. Bill is our fearless leader and the founder of NASCA. He is on the line as well to support our special guest. So sometimes the panel grows as we continue the show, and that is perfectly fine for people to call in when they can. Let me tell you a little bit about John before I bring him on. As I mentioned, John Michael Landers from Kettering, Ohio. He states he grew up in a poor family in a small farm community in Ohio. Quote from John, "My parents were barely living from paycheck to paycheck, feeding and raising 6 children." John participated in the sport of springboard and platform diving. So when he was 15 years old, he took an 8 in the Junior Olympics and dreamed about the Olympics when a lawyer presented him and his mother an offer that she could not refuse. So through this lawyer, John, who had this extreme talent, was introduced to coaches, a medical team, and sponsors who, instead of supporting him appropriately, sexually abused him. So I'm going to leave John's bio. There's a lot more that he provided us with. I'm going to leave it right there since we're in the first segment. And John, I'm going to unmute your microphone and welcome you to the show, John. You're on. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
So the first question I have is really a hard one. Did I
say
your name correctly? John Michael Landers.
That's correct. Sorry about that.
Okay. Oh, no, it's fine. It's okay. Can you hear me all right? We're coming on the show tonight and welcome you to NASCA. Is this your first show with us?
Yes, it is.
Okay, well, we welcome you. And I'd like to say that I applaud you because I think that takes a lot of courage to come on and tell your story. And just by you coming on and your willingness to be on the show, you're inspiring somebody else who's at a beginning stage of their recovery, and you're inspiring them to do the same. So I want to acknowledge that and just recognize that.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. It says you grew up in a poor family in a small farm community in Ohio. So would you be comfortable, and by the way, any question that comes at you, any question I ask you or anybody from the panel, anything that comes up that you don't wish to talk about, that's perfectly fine. So you can just pass. There's no right or wrong here. This is your time to tell us your story in the way that you're most comfortable. But if you are comfortable, would you mind telling us, just so we can all get a snapshot and a picture, some context to your upbringing and from your earliest memories and what your family was like and your childhood was like?
Sure, not a problem. I grew up in a small farm town area in southwestern Ohio, and my parents were very religious, and they wanted to have as many children as they can, so they started to adopt children. And there were 3 natural children, and then the rest of the children were adopted. They also had foster kids, so we had people coming in and going out of our house all the time, which was kind of exciting and kind of confusing and all those wonderful things that happen as a child as you're trying to figure it out. By the time I was 15, I had started diving and started going to national championships. And at 15, I took 8th at the Junior Olympics, which kind of propelled me into the spotlight of future Olympics. And unfortunately, my parents, again, were not very well off, and so we were living paycheck to paycheck. And so a lawyer had read about my accomplishments in the local newspaper and contacted my mother and started talking with her and saying that he had a group of people that would be happy to help with finances, and they were other professional people. And so she was like interested in it.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, and this is all great, and we want to hear about this part too. But getting back to your family and to your memories, so can you just maybe give us a little bit of background on how many biological brothers and sisters did you have, and then how many foster children were in the home at any time? A little bit more background about just the family, your family of origin.
Like I said, that there were three natural children.
Okay.
And then the rest were fosters because my mother wasn't supposed to be able to have any more children. So we constantly, there could have been times.
Oh, I'm just curious as to where you were in the birth order, and do you have like a sisters or brothers or?
I was the middle, and I had an older brother and a younger sister.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. And then there are foster children, and you were about to tell us how many were there as they came in.
Well, there was any number because my parents opened the house up, but my parents did adopt three of those foster children. So there would be times that we may have 8 or 10 kids in the house.
Okay, and in terms of your parents, and in terms of just how your childhood went with, you know, between 6 and 8, and sometimes, you know, all those 10 kids in the house, were they pretty adept and capable of managing all those children at, you know, at the same time? And what was the environment like? Was it chaotic? Was it calm? I'm just curious. I'm just trying to understand, like, what your home life was like a little bit more.
Well, first of all, I really don't see what that has to do with what happened to me later on. But my family was Catholic. My father was, and my mother was Methodist, and so they just wanted to open their house up to children, and they felt that that was the best way that they could do it. And also, you've got to remember, at that time, there was the government assistance that every time they would foster somebody, there was more money brought into the house. So I think that's where they got caught up in that whole cycle. We shared everything. There could be up to 5 kids in one bedroom. We shared our clothes with them, and at that point, I think it was very, very beneficial because the natural children learned how to share and accept these new people into their lives every time, and we never knew if they were going to be there the next week. So there was always kind of this unsettledness of what's going to happen to the kids. And I think that was a part one issue because you never knew when they were going to be taken away. And there was also the fear of wanting to create a friendship with them. Do I become friends with this young person and they are removed from us? And then, you know, and then there was always the problem of having the children steal from us, from, you know, because when they left, they took whatever they could. So there was a lot of different things going in. I think the natural children had this whole question of, aren't we good enough? Why do we have to open our house to everybody else? So there was a lot of that going on. But my parents are very proud and very strong about we must share and love each other for who we are. And I think that's the thing that really stuck with me with all the foster kids.
So it sounds like you were raised in a pretty, I mean, your house, your parents, and that it was nurturing, giving, of service, right? Religious.
Correct.
So I'm just,
yes.
You were nurtured. You were in a safe place. And that's really
totally
where
safe.
We're trying. Yeah. Okay.
Oh, yes.
It wasn't
a dysfunctional family. I mean, I think every family is dysfunctional to a certain extent, but it was all about love and giving and understanding and being gracious with each other.
Wonderful. And that's what we were going to get. Right. Thank you. And that's the context that we like to, because these shows, believe it or not, people are streaming in. Sometimes a lot of them are, you know, and they also get archived. And so survivors, other people looking for, you know, hope and healing go and listen to these shows over the years. And so it's really helpful, believe it or not, to have that kind of info. So thank you for your willingness to give us a picture of that.
My pleasure.
So so then you were mentioning then that at 15, you were given an opportunity. You had this amazing talent of diving. Springboard platform diving. Okay, as a mom of 3 boys, I can just tell you that would make my heart stop watching my child do that sport. Just saying. But that's incredible. So I'll let you continue your story.
Well, and basically that's the, you know, the situation. We were, I don't even know where to go from here on this angle. Having placed eighth in the nation was a shock to everybody because of where I came from. And it was also kind of like a gift. You could say it was God-given gift because no one else in my family was a diver. And so it was like this challenge because my father didn't have a great job and there were all these kids at home to feed. And there's this sport, which is very expensive. And diving, believe it or not, is one of the most expensive sports besides figure skating there is. So there was all these confrontations, not confrontations, but challenges is the word I was looking for, to face. And so when this lawyer read about me in the newspaper, he approached my mother and started talking with her. And they met several times before I ever met the lawyer. And the lawyer presented this incredible picture to her about the fact that he had a group of people who were professionals that would be willing to help my family and also help me with the diving expenses. And so he set up a fund at a local bank, and people could donate, and then all of a sudden all these professionals were actually putting money in. And then what I had to do, basically just to my mom's, according to my mom, was to go have dinner with these people. And that's how it all started. And so what had happened is that I would go have dinner, and of course the dinner was not just dinner. And they would pass me around. And every time I would go have dinner, someone in the family or something in the family would get a doctor's appointment. My sister, my natural sister, had a terrible sledding accident and had to have reconstruction surgery on her chin, and that was all taken care of. But unfortunately, I don't think they realized what the price was. And then, of course, I was moving forward in diving, and so all my diving expenses were taken care of, so like a scholarship in a way, and that's how they presented it to her. So basically, they groomed my mother first before they even came to me. And then after that, they went to my coach, and they offered my coach extra money if he would pay attention to me. And unfortunately, the coach himself had issues, and so he decided to take advantage of it and started inviting me to take overnight trips to the university, which was like an hour and a half away, and we would spend the night. And then he would introduce me to alcohol, and then one thing would lead to another thing, and then all of a sudden, but I thought he really liked me. And at this point, after being passed around to all the professionals, I was confused what my sexual orientation was. I was called all these names, and I just assumed, okay, this is what I'm supposed to be, I guess. I didn't understand why God would put me through this. What did I do? What sins had I created that I have to do this? I remember one time when person came up to the house, drove up in a Lincoln Town car, and I didn't want to go. And my mom was right there at the door, and I said, I'm not going, and she asked me why. And I said, because he touches me, and I thought this would be the time that I can finally break this. And this had been going on for almost a year now. And she said, what do you mean? And I explained it to her, and then she slapped me across the face and said, it is not nice to make up lies about people like this. This is a professional. Aww. The community loves him. He's doing everything well for the family, and it's your job to do your part for the family as well. Go have dinner. And I was actually ushered out the house to this guy waiting in the car. So when I believed that my mom was not going to believe me, I decided no one would believe me because everyone else told me that no one would and that everything had to be kept secret. And so I just started creating ways of dealing with it and getting through the next situation to the next situation. How do I get through this? And so it became about creating all these different like little personas, I called them. And so at the same time, I'm preparing to go to Norway at the time for the Norway Cup, which was a huge international meet. And my coach started telling me that, you know, my other teammates were jealous of me because I was getting international trips to Norway and Canada and Germany and England, and they were still staying in Ohio. And so he started to tell me that he was the only person that I could trust. So then again, my teenage mind is confused, thinking, oh, this person really cares about me. And so I fell into that.
Well, you were definitely gaslighted. And I don't mean to interrupt you, but we're almost kind of to the third of the show.
Okay.
Had it passed by. Would you be okay if I broke to the panel right now?
Sure, fine.
Okay. And I think, you know, it really resonates with me is that those that preyed upon you initially, I don't know if it said the paper, any information about your family having also being a foster family, but it's almost that, you know, all the free medical help that your other family members were receiving from this grooming and courtship of you by this lawyer, you know, through this lawyer to these coaches and medical team, it sounds to me like they knew that your family was one of service, and here you were preyed upon not only for your talent, but also for the fact that you were taught to serve others, right? And here, you know, what you're being subjected to, there were benefits to your family, right? I'm just not wanting to speak for you, but I just see the parallel there and how manipulative perpetrators can be. Right.
Correct. I do want to share. I don't know if all the perpetrators looked at me that way. If I can be so blunt, I think that there's this, I call it a pod of professionals. We're more interested in what they could get for a cheap price, basically, is what it was. And I don't think, like, besides the lawyer, I don't think the others were invested to find out what my family was like, because the lawyer had already done that and shared what information. And so they just said, oh, okay. But this group took care of each other, if that makes sense. So the lawyer would protect the doctors. And so they were all in this little cocoon, I guess you would call it. And so, yeah.
Sounds like they had their ring down to a science.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to break to the panel. Thank you for what you've shared so far. And I'm going to bring Bill on. Bill Murray, our founder and CEO. Bill, good evening.
Well, I'm absolutely delighted to be here. Thank you very much. Penelope, I appreciate the opportunity to assist you tonight. I don't often get to be on a show where you're the host, and I think you do a great job. I just wanted to say that out loud for everybody to hear. Penelope's wonderful. John, we really appreciate your coming on tonight's show, and I have a tremendous amount of identification with you. And that's because there are many similarities in our actual story. And that doesn't always happen with guests. A lot of people's facts of their life as they grew up and were abused as children don't match other people's facts, but their feelings do, and their emotional states do, and their decision-making and the trauma that's brought on in adulthood, they all match, even if the story doesn't. But tonight, I'm hearing a lot of my own story because I, too, was abused as a child. I was adopted, first of all, as an infant, and so was my sister. So there were two of us in the family. And when I got to be of the right age, my parents sent me off into what they believed was a great opportunity for me at, I think I was age 11, to a camp, a summer camp, where they had all kinds of activities, and I was staying there for a month. And it turned out that one of the people at the summer camp who was the camp's swimming pool person, you know, the head of swimming events, and also the photographer for the camp, you know, found me attractive and approached me, and I didn't know what was going on, but he began molesting me almost right away the first year I was there. The point being that I went there for 3 years in a row, and I couldn't say anything. I just didn't know what was going on. I had no information about any of these activities, so I kept quiet in between the school years, did terribly, but went back twice more, and the whole time he took photographs of me. I was his model for naked little boy pictures, but I was also his assistant. And so the benefit for me, unlike having, say, training in diving, was to learn photography. And he gave me wonderful cameras, you know, Nikons, and showed me how to use the dark room and the printing and everything. And I learned a skill that actually had an impact on the career I was later to have. So that was one of his draws. And his paying off to my parents came in the fact that he also took a lot of photographs for the camp itself, including legitimate ones of me that he gave to my parents. So Bill at the campfire, Bill on horseback, Bill in a canoe, Bill swimming in the pool, those kinds of pictures. And they were wonderful. He was a great photographer. So this is very similar. And he eventually kidnapped me, took me to Canada. I was gone for 2.5 weeks. And when I got back, it was the beginning of high school for me. And I went to a minor seminary because I, too, was raised Catholic and very Catholic. And I had expressed an interest in the possibility of pursuing priesthood. And just to make this a short story, I ended up at the school where there were pedophile priests and brothers, and they, you called it a pod. I would call it like a ring or whatever. But, you know, it's a group of people who understand each other's needs, and they kind of share kids with each other. And this happens not only in societies like you and I are talking about, but it happens in the regular world too, where pedophiles actually share kids, and they obviously protect each other in doing so. So there's a huge amount of similarity is what I'm saying. You know, I really appreciate your coming on because, you know, you're telling a significant part of my story. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Bill, for sharing that anytime to hear someone else acknowledge or have the same type of feelings, it's always reaffirming. And thank you for being transparent and sharing that.
It's my pleasure. That's what we do here. And it's in the sharing back and forth that the newcomer who's listening tonight, or as Penelope said, might listen in the future, will find the identification. And they'll say to themselves, well, maybe if those guys can do it, I might be able to do it someday too. And that's it. I mean, that's the miracle.
That's
so
right.
Again, thank you, John, and I'll throw it back to Penelope. Appreciate it, Penelope.
Oh, thank you, Bill. And John and Bill, it is really my honor to be the host this evening, and John, for you to entrust me to help facilitate you telling your story. I do appreciate that. I'm going to bring on Peter from Ontario. If my computer is very slow. Peter, I just unmuted your line, and you are on with John.
G'day, Penelope, and
g'day
to you. Way to go. And g'day to you, Bill. G'day, John. I just want to say you're doing quite the job there of sharing your story. I quite the family that you're in. I mean, I wasn't quite in my time. I wasn't quite in such a big family. I was brought up with a family just of two, myself and my youngest sister. And then when my father remarried, it was 5 extra kids, and I was pretty much the oldest in the whole family. So it was pretty much me crawling up to the top to get away from all the trouble. But I just want to say you have my support. I mean, I feel your pain as far as abuse and sexual abuse is concerned, and I'm looking forward to hearing more of your story. So you have my support, and I will hand it back over to you, Penelope, and you are doing a very good job, if I may say as well.
Oh, thank you, Peter, and thank you for your comments to John, and just for your support. I always hear we need more men to come forward and talk and support, and not that we don't base our preferences for special guest men on sex or gender, but I've heard that, you know, it's we need more male voices to come forward and show that courage, and as you and both Bill had stated, to just, you know, let others know that it's okay to speak out and let it out. So thank you. So John,
yes.
this show, I know that 90 minutes sounds like a long time, but we're past the first half hour. So we're in the second segment. And I know, I don't want to say time flies when you're having fun, because I wouldn't put that in the fun category, but the show does seem to fly by. And we do sometimes laugh on the show, and it's not because we're being disrespectful. Sometimes it's just laughter is good medicine, because this is tough stuff, right? So
correct. It is.
I'm going to turn it back to you. Back to you and where you want to pick up.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'm blown away, to be honest with you, Penelope. First of all, you're amazing. It's been really, I know at the very beginning I was kind of thrown about what was happening and everything, but your transparency and your gentleness and your approach is just incredible. So thank you for that. Second of all, I just also want to say that I'm blown away by the fact that Peter and Bill are speaking on tonight, which I've never have ever been in a conversation or a podcast or anything with other men. It's always been with women, and this is eye-opening to me tonight. So thank you for this whole thing. It's really an amazing situation, and I hope people out who are listening understand how special this is, to have three male voices at one time. So, wow.
Wow,
I guess
profound, profound. Thank you for saying that. That's very profound. Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, I guess where I could pick up is that once I got out of high school, I did go to Norway, and I did win the gold medal, which was crazy to a lot of people. And I set myself up for the Olympics. And then, unfortunately, the abuse got so bad that I mentally wasn't able to go forward in my sport. So I got a scholarship out to the University of California, Irvine, and I thought this would be my chance to reinvent myself. It was all about getting away from everyone that I thought I was getting away from, to put everything in the past behind me and go forward. But unfortunately, if we do not get help professionally, we cannot really move forward. We could pretend we are, and we could tell ourselves that, and we can create a false sense of security that we are doing that. But what we're doing a lot of times, and I don't know if the other two men would agree with this, is that we unconsciously will repeat situations and scenarios without even being aware of it. And that's exactly what happened to me at the university. A grad student started to stalk me and follow me, and the next thing I know, he has invited me into his apartment, and it was the worst night I've ever. Now, that was the night that I felt like it broke the camel's back. I had gone through all high school dealing with all the professionals, but I, in my mind, had completely convinced myself that it was normal. This was how I was going to become an elite athlete, and this is how athletes had what they had to do. This is what they had to go through. It was all part of becoming that gold medal winner. And then when I got to college, I was no longer that. And so I tried to find my new identity. And then I run into this situation. And then I had to go to the hospital after the incident and to be re-victimized by the medical team and be told that it was my fault, that I entered the room, that I must have allowed this to happen, that the drink that he gave me after later on they found out was drugged had nothing to do with it. It was all about my fault and about my sins, basically. And so I went into a really deep depression. I got very sick. I found myself, I like to think that I physically made myself sick so that I could go back and heal. And so I had to go back to Ohio to my parents, back into the ring, the pod of professionals, without even really, really understanding why. But I had to regroup and had to get well again. And so that's where that all led to. That was my freshman year in college. But while I was at the university, I had met a young woman who I thought was the greatest thing in the world. And she was a theater major. And so she had me audition with her. I auditioned. I got the play. And at the same time, they were auditioning for a movie of the week. And I got one of the leads for the movie of the week as well. And so that led me into my first professional job. And also it got me on a roll with General Hospital out there. And so I was thrust into this new environment, this professional world of acting. And I guess would say mentally maybe not was prepared for it, because I put myself back into a ring of people who wanted to manipulate and to take advantage of young people. And that's what Hollywood was at that time. And so, again, I found myself being passed around to people. And so that kind of takes me up to that middle section that you were talking about, Penelope. I don't know how much more to emphasize on that, except the fact that as this whole time is going on, the more depressed I became, more depressed, more anxiety. I started having suicidal thoughts because I didn't know how to handle the thought processes that were going inside of my mind. I have now learned, as I've gotten older and done research, that a teenager's mind is not fully developed until their late 20s. And so in my mind, I had to rethink and reconfigure how the synapses were going to fire and reorganize things, because I was always on a defensive stage. I was always very ready to run and flee because I didn't feel safe. And so then I put myself into a career that was just as bad as the diving career was, with the pedophiles and the opportunists and the manipulators and the groomers. And it was just another craziness about everything. So I found myself disassociating a lot and creating different personas just to be able to get through. Acting was very successful. I did a lot of shows. I did a lot of stage work. I ended up moving to New York to study with a famous theater teacher. And I also felt that New York was a place where I could be just figure out who I am. LA, I was not allowed to be gay, straight, bi. I had to be one thing. And so I didn't feel comfortable there. And so when I went to New York, I found myself dancing. I went on Broadway. I started doing all this incredible things, but I was never healing myself. So there would be moments of weeks of depression or moments of total freakouts, if you want to call it that. But I was lucky enough because whenever I did a role or took a part in a play or a film or something, I was able to be somebody else. And that in itself was a saving grace because I could remove myself from what I was feeling so that I could feel what the actor or the character was feeling. And I think that's what kept me going and kept me moving forward.
Oh, I can so relate to everything that you're saying.
And
I really truly believe that is the one of the most beautiful things about NAFTA is we are adult survivors of child abuse, and as Bill just always so articulately states, so I'm going to imitate or just repeat, but experiences may be different, very different, but the feelings a lot of times are the same. And, you know, and that's the place where you can say, well, I dissociated, and everybody understands what that is. We've all had, you know, different experience with dissociation, right?
Correct.
Or, you know, victims of, and I would say, if this is okay, I mean, you experienced complex childhood trauma and abuse. I mean, you were not allowed. At 15, your development was severely stifled. How do you mature and grow? Build esteem with what you were subjected to. I think it's really, really hard. You get stifled, you get stuck, and you don't have you were robbed of that opportunity. I mean, you were robbed of your innocence. You were robbed of your ability to trust. You were robbed of your ability to be able to say the truth to your, you know, to your family. Unfortunately, your mother's reaction, she did the best she could at the time, I'm sure, but nothing's worse than not being believed.
Right.
When you share something like that, so everything, you know, everything you're saying, I know that I can relate to, and to me, that's, I believe NAFTA just offers not only the platform of the show, but just as survivors, we understand, you know, we understand.
Right.
And by the way, I went to UC Davis. I'm a fellow UC, you know, alum.
Huh? I dove in your pool.
Yeah. Actually, I'd also consider going to UC Irvine because I thought that was a very nice campus. But
beautiful campus.
You know,
yeah.
What's amazing to me is that despite all of this maltreatment, severe maltreatment, from the age of 15, you were very successful in everything that you put your fingers on. You were a successful diver. When you said you won gold when you went to Norway, that's pretty amazing that you were able to function at that level, at that competitive level. From the same token, I mean, a lot of us have shared our story, we can relate to hitting a wall where mm-hmm. the trauma becomes so heavy that you just cannot function. You can't perform, right?
Right.
And I feel it's just heaviness. What I heard you, I mean, I heard you saying, you know, you were, you know, the body is in different states, right? There's a state of fight or flight. There's a state of frozen.
Right.
That's the new part of the polyvagal theory. And then there's, you know, that parasympathetic where you're at rest, you know, you're at rest. And I'm getting the sense, and I think from some of the words you use, you were just in this constant state. And unfortunately, you were constantly, in situations
exploited.
Where there's another. Right, exactly. Did you ever feel like, is there a target on my back? Like, why? Why is this happening to me again?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I want to get to that question, but I want to jump back to something you just asked earlier, how I was able to get through a lot of it. And I do think, mm-hmm. and I really believe this, because of just speaking with you tonight, things are going off in my head that are answering some questions. I do know that my parents set an amazing basic boundary, not boundaries, but basic information in me about spirituality and stuff like that. And I do know that when, you know, we all talked about it when we were younger, and it was all when it was just the family and my brother and I at the time. And I think that's where I got that strength to be able to just keep moving forward. Also, I want to share is that I think each survivor has their own way of dealing with things. So my way was I had to be perfect, which is an illness in itself. I had to have the 4.0 at school. I had to be the best diver. I had to be the best actor. I had to be the best at everything. And when things got to the point that I wasn't is when things started to spiral as well, which happened later. But I think that's the driving force behind me at the time, is that I could not be anything less than the best. And I think that's why I was able to have such success at such an early age through different avenues, actually. But then getting to this last part, I think the problem that I realized now that I look back is, yes, the events themselves were crazy. I can't even find the right words to say what they were. But it was the attachments and the meanings that I put to the feelings afterwards, if that makes sense, Penelope. I literally would start re-victimizing myself. I started creating a horrible sense of worth. I was never good enough. I was never smart enough. I was never worthy enough. And I would constantly, when any type of situation would arise or challenge me, those were the first thoughts that came up. And so the two things that would follow that would be either fight and make sure that I get as far as I can and be the best that I can, or all this other stuff is going to come out. And I was fighting so hard to hide all the other things. And I think that's what led me to where I, you know, to what I got to do and the experiences I had. But I know other people, it would go the other way. They started doing really bad in school. They almost would fail out, or they would become aggressive and they would act out other ways. I do know that when I was going through high school, I wanted to be heard. I think every child wants to be heard if they're going through something like this. And they want their parents to know. And I would find different ways to try to get their attention, because I knew that speaking it was not going to work because my mother proved that already. So I would change certain behaviors that I was usually – I used to be immaculate. I could not have dirt on me anywhere. And all of a sudden, I was going for weeks without showering and wearing the same clothes. I never cussed. And I found myself every once in a while out of anguish, I would throw out a curse word as loud as I could. And yet my parents would just look at that and say, oh, that just must be the teenage years that they're going through. But they never took the moment at that time to find out what really was happening. And I really think that if they sat me down and said, what's going on, I probably would have spilled it all out.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was in that desire or that desperation to speak the truth so much so. But I knew that I couldn't be the one to bring it up. It's how I felt, because then I would be a disappointment in their eyes. So it's all these false selves that we create that keeps us trapped, I think.
Totally relate to everything you just said. I think perfection is a great addiction. It's a great addiction because it's an impossible goal to achieve, really. And you can get pretty far, right? It's a great, we talk a lot, there's a lot of commonalities, a lot of adult survivors about, issues or different numbing escapes, alcoholism and drugs and sex and things like that. Mine was perfection. I totally can relate. In fact, when I was told and went to therapy to start writing anything, I wrote down, perfection is my protection. I thought if I was perfect, right, it would stop.
Penelope, I have to tell you, you have to write a book called that. That's your book title, Penelope. I'm sorry. You have to write a book. That's a great title. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but that just,
Thank you for saying that. But I'm just saying that because this is not my story, but I totally can relate to that. And you touched upon something else. I'm going to break to the panel in a moment also, if that's okay. But, the journey to self-love for an adult survivor, an adult that goes through, is a very long journey, right? So you touched upon that, right? Because there's so much self-hatred that comes from the trauma and the sexual abuse and the abuse. And that's a big part of the journey, and that's a big part of the emotional can be more penetrating and enduring, I think, than the physical, and that's part of it is the self-love that you touched upon, because I don't think it's very self-loving to try and be perfect, right? Because we're setting ourselves up for something that's you were very successful. You got very, very, very far. You achieved great success in everything that you put your hands on. But and it can serve us all to a certain extent, right? But in a way, it's the way you wear a mask, because people would think, oh my gosh, John, like he's everything. He's like he's the Olympic diver, and he, goes into, acting, and he's like already on General Hospital, and he's, successful. And so people, it's almost like you put on this mask where no one would ever, ever think anything other than this guy's amazing, right?
Correct.
And never really believe, if they knew the truth, that would be something they would never have considered.
Correct. Well,
all right, well, I'm going to break. I'm sorry, go on. Okay, I'm going to bring on Bill again, and you probably already figured this out, but there's a little bit of a delay when someone speaks, and so it is what it is, and sometimes it sounds like people are talking over each other, and I try not to do that, but it's going to happen a couple more times, and so I'm going to apologize for that in advance. But all right, I'm going to bring on Bill. Bill, you are unmuted.
Yes.
You're back on with
me. Thank you very much. Yes. Now, our stories have some similarities, and now they're going to have some differences. As I said, I was raised in a Catholic family. I was raised in an extremely Catholic family environment and community. So, again, part of the grooming of my parents was the fact that I was, I was proceeding in Catholicism. I did all the sacraments, I was an altar boy at 5:30 Mass for years. I'd ride my bike there, and so forth. And when I went to the summer camp, I was, made to feel special. I think I was looking for love. I was looking for attention and love. And when he put a camera in my hand, that helped me a lot to give me my own sort of specialness. When he took me on the kidnapping trip at the end of the third summer, he introduced me to numerous pedophiles and their young boys, and tried to get me to interact with them. And because I refused, he got more and more angry. But we went through all over New York, Coney Island, Vermont, to a little nudist boy camp for nudist little boys, and eventually ended up in Canada, because the whole opportunity for the trip was supposedly to go see the World's Fair called Expo 67, which they had in Montreal. And in any case, then I went off to high school after only 2 weeks home. I didn't say anything, and I was molested again, and then again, and then again. And, you know, by the first 2 years of my experience at the Minor Seminary, where I lived like 800 miles from my folks, I didn't go home all the time. In fact, I only went home Thanksgiving, Christmas, and Easter. You know, I was alone. And what I discovered was that when I became a – and I nearly flunked out of everything. I was just the opposite. I was horrible in school. And I flunked some things that, you know, didn't make sense to flunk, like history. You know, I had to take it in summer school to come back. And when I was a junior, I had a growth spurt, and I turned, you know, tougher. I turned, I became pimply, a little bit pimply, and I was just tougher. And that's when I started my process of not bathing and all this. And I think it was just trying to be less attractive, and it worked.
Right.
Because in junior and senior year, I excelled in all my courses, and I had found in my high school years my voice, literally. I found it both in singing, which I sang. I always sang since I was a child. But in high school, I was given platforms, privileges, solo parts. And I sang every kind of music there was. And I also got into the Forensic League, which is about oratory, speaking. And I excelled in that, which was unexpected. But I have found that even today I can – talk about anything for 30 minutes if you give me a 2-minute warning, you know. when I went off to college the first time, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, basically. And the rock and roll showed up in the form of learning how to play guitar, which I'd never been introduced to a musical instrument before. I was a freshman in college, and I was a natural. The singing progressed. The drinking and using of drugs was immediate, over-drinking and over-drugging. And for the first time, I was around girls, really. I didn't have an experience with girls in high school.
Right.
So, boy, through my 20s, I went through lots of girls. I did not have a question about whether I was a homosexual or not. I didn't even know what that was at the beginning. I learned it was something you were supposed to not be called, you know, be ashamed about and all this. I didn't feel like I was one because I'd never been attracted to the men. So I just tried to prove my heterosexuality by sleeping with every girl that said, okay, you know, and there were a lot of them. And ultimately, I told my parents, who didn't know what to do about the story of my life, when I was in my mid-20s, and by then it was too late. I was a full-blown alcoholic and drug addict and so forth.
Wow.
And I went back to school at NYU, and I nearly finished the degree, did not finish, through the Gallatin Division for Film, TV, and Journalism, of which became my career path. In the process of doing that, I went to the Strasberg Institute. I went to modern dance class. I took ballet. I did all those things you mentioned, but never as an actor. I wish I was. I wanted to be. And I was told, you know, if you spend 3 years doing this kind of work, meaning like the Strasberg work, for example, you'll have a great career. And I couldn't wait. To me, it was too long.
Right,
so,
right.
I mean, I had a very spotty career, and it went the other direction. It went into more like production and post-production. I had a spotty career all through my life. But, you know, I got sober and clean at age 30 in Los Angeles, where I had moved with my future wife, started a film company, a video company, and I've been in recovery ever since. I just turned 68. So I'm in my 39th year of recovery. And, you know, you can't take that away from me, even though a lot of those 39 years, they were not necessarily happy years. They were not necessarily, at least from what the outside would look at, successful years, but they were meaningful years. These have been the years of my growth, and of course I've ended up today extremely comfortable with who Bill is, and it didn't take me 30 years. But that's my path. I took the other course is the point, you know, that you mentioned. Whereas you became a perfectionist, I became as depraved as I could be, pretty much, you know. And so, but we get our different facts. I felt horrible about Bill. I was deeply depressed. You know, I was morose. I was so depressed. You know, it took what it took to get to eventually a recovery group in Hollywood and start my healing journey. So there you go. I really think this is a great show. I love the fact that there are three men here too, John, and I appreciate you being our special guest.
Well, thank you very much, and congratulations. That's what you have done is amazing, and I don't think people realize how difficult a journey that is that you've taken, and you are a success. So thank you for sharing that.
My privilege.
And I have to say that I've never been on the show with three men, and I'm having the time of my life, believe it or not. Not that I don't love Pamela and Tammy and Carol. Just saying. This is great. I'm the female voice.
Oh, wow. Right. And it's a powerful one.
And, you know, and I have to say that not only is Bill in his 39th year of recovery, and happy birthday, by the way, Bill, and any of you NASCA family members that want to go on the NASCA website, www.nasca.org, there's a special birthday tribute to Bill. So please acknowledge that. But he's built this platform for other adult survivors where he's given us helped us shed the shame and find a place where, again, our experiences may be different, but our feelings are a lot the same, and we're able to continue and grow, you know, in our healing with this community that he's built. So I had to acknowledge that as well, because if it hadn't been for NASCA for me, after I remembered that I was molested by my own father, I don't know how I would have continued the healing process without it. So with that being said, not my story tonight. This is about John.
No, but I'm sorry to interrupt, but your story is important and very, because I think everyone's story is, and for you sharing how you were able to succeed through this organization, that's huge, and it needs to be heard.
Thank you. Well, there is something I think very, very, very impactful about coming on the show, as you have, and I know you're going to get into your healing journey in the next segment. We're going to hear more about that, and I don't know how many other public platforms you've taken to tell your story, but to come and tell your story to the world, to me, was a huge leap in the healing process, right? That platform was a huge leap, you know, to put it out there, right? And instead of thinking I won't be able to, you know, show my face in public tomorrow, I actually for the first time felt that I could.
Right.
So that's what NASCA and this platform. And like I said, I don't know how many shows you've been on, but that is, I think, the beauty of and the courage that it takes to come on the show as you are. So I am not going to forget about Peter. Sometimes I have never forgotten Peter, but Peter should not be forgotten. So I'm going to run Peter now. I'm sure he has a question or comment for you. And Peter, you are on with John.
G'day, Penelope. Well, anyone would forget me. That's simple. I'm Australian. What do you expect? John was saying, you know, as far as sharing stories is concerned, I mean, Penelope, I've never heard your story. I shouldn't say that you've sort of like shared a little bit with me. And with Bill, you know, with Bill, I mean, I was on last night and hearing hearing majority of his story last night. I don't know you all that well yet, Bill, but I'm sort of like growing to understand of your talk. And John, I was on this radio not so long ago, or back in January, to share my story as a survivor from sexual molestation and to sexual abuse and physical abuse, not just from the the sexual molestation from my sexual abuser, but the domestic violence with my family, you know, I give you kudos for pushing forward as far as you wanting to concentrate, you know, doing your sport and doing other things. You know, it was very, for me, it was more like the opposite because, you know, according to my mother and my father, sport doesn't bring marks home. Singing with a choir does not bring marks home from the school. Being involved in drama and plays does not bring your marks home. I'm meant to be at school learning, you know, and so, you know, I did a tryout to play representative soccer for my city in Newcastle, but I missed the opportunity because I wasn't allowed to, because again, soccer does not bring school marks home. And so for me, you know, even though I did play soccer as a junior, but I still didn't get that opportunity. But kudos for you to, you know, speak to anyone that gets gold medals to represent their country. You know, it's amazing. I mean, that would be something I would love to feel honored to achieve something. I mean, the only thing I could say that I can honor as far as my country is concerned is that before the 2000 Olympics in Sydney, I had that opportunity of doing a relay run with the Olympic torch. That's one of my memorable moments as far as the Olympic Games is concerned. And what I'm listening from you, John, is wow. You know, and again with you, John, if you're hearing me, what's new? You're here in Australia all the time. But I enjoy your story too, mate. And Penelope, you just rock. I mean, I don't know how you're feeling with three men around you. But, well, make it four because you got Mark that says mute. So he's just about ready to mute me in a minute. So. So I'm going to hand it back to you, Penelope, but John, kudos, mate. You know, you went the right direction, I went the opposite direction, and it's sad on some areas where, you know, guys like us, that we want to focus on that opportunity to do something, but most of us cannot get that opportunity, but there's some of us that will get that opportunity. And for me, I had the opportunity with my grandfather of getting involved in photography. So that's my goal, is running my own photography business. So I'm handing it back to you, Penelope. You're doing a great show. That's all I'm going to say. That, you know, I'm really happy with tonight's show. Very well done.
Well, thank you, Peter. I'll give John an opportunity to respond if he wishes before I continue.
I just want to thank you so much for all the things you have said. And I think our journeys are separate in certain ways, but we still carry the shame and the guilt and the grief that we went through, and how we process that is kind of like, I think, going back to what Bill said, is similar. How we try to find our journey and how we find it, although the journeys are all separate and different, but we're all still searching for acceptance of ourselves. And I think that's really the beauty of what life is really about. And to be able to do it in such a venue and share my story and hear you share your story is just very healing. Thank you.
You're welcome, John. I mean, you said something about with. You know, and I heard John saying something too. I'm talking to John. Bill, you know, you both were saying in similarity of stories about knowing your orientation. You know, I was the same way that I would go, after with all my abuse, I would go out to explore. But, you know, to know who I was, and, you know, But, you know, I'm also a 31-year long-time survivor living with HIV due to the fact of being sexually abused. So, you know, it is a long journey. The journey will end for me at some point. But anyway, my journey is going to stop right now because it's all about you tonight, Dawn. Have fun.
Thank you, Peter. And first of all, I feel every morning that I wake up, and the fact that I'm alive and I survived, every morning I'm born again, and it's what I do every day that matters the most. I think it's important to grieve what's been lost in the past, but I feel like once you're in the healing process, your life really starts. So I'm still in my infancy. I've got a whole life ahead of me. So, I don't know. You might see me in the Olympics. Maybe. I don't know.
Sounds great.
A 51-year-old woman in the Olympics. Maybe. Who knows? So
why not?
why not, right? I mean, I think really, truly, that is some of the beauty, right, of healing, is that you live a different kind of life. Life starts over. In a very different way. So, and moving on, and I'm looking at your bio. So you now, John, speak out about your experiences. And it's you say that you're getting the word out in many ways. So you've written the serial, Surface series based on my traumatic experience, including Surface Tension, called Cracked Surface. So I'm interested in hearing about that. And soon you're publishing Broken Surface. And you've spoken for 2 years, the National Coalition to End Sexual Exploitation Global Summit in D.C. And I'm going to stop talking because there's so much good stuff here. So we've got, I know I said the 90 minutes goes by fast. We have 22 minutes left. I'm going to turn these 20. I know, right? I'm going to turn them over to you, and you can take that 22 minutes to, you know, maybe do like a real, how do you fast forward the real, right, maybe from where we left off to where you are, maybe sprinkle in some healing process on there so there's just some continuity in your chronology, but I'm giving the next 22 minutes to you.
Oh, wow. Okay, thank you. I think the thing that I should share is how I began my journey of healing. And I think what happened with that is that my parents both got sick, so I came back home to help them. And while I was here taking care of my parents in Ohio, I got my teaching license, and I started teaching at the High School of Performing Arts, and I was teaching English, sophomores. And I had a young man come in and tell me that he was gay, and I was like, so, okay, what? No big deal. I could care less. But then he told me that he had a boyfriend that was 35. And all of a sudden, all this red flag started coming up because he was the age that I was when all this started happening. And I told him that I was going to have to report it. And he seemed to be okay with that. And he thought that, you know, that's great. And I thought he wanted me to. And when I did go to the assistant principal with it, the assistant principal told me that there was nothing that they could do because his mother and grandmother were aware of it and that they supported it. And I asked him why he was dating a 35-year-old man when he was only 15. And he said, well, this man pays for the bills and takes care of the groceries. And that's what really set me into opening up all the wounds again, mm-hmm. and starting to go back and hearing the old voices, and everything started to open up like Pandora's box again. And I was really frustrated and angry with the school system because they weren't helping this young man after I even reported it again to them. And I felt like he wanted me to help him, and I felt like I failed him. So what had happened after that is I actually resigned from the school, and I started this whole process again. And it's like an onion and peeling back the layers and finding more stuff that I had ignored or denied. And it got to the point that it got so bad that I actually wrote my partner of 15 years at that time a goodbye letter. And I said goodbye to my two Boston Terriers, and I went into the garage and I turned on the car. And it was crazy as that sounds. As I sat there, I kind of had this feeling that this wasn't fair for Nathan to come home and find me. I mean, he didn't do this. Why does he have to pay for it? So, and then I felt myself say, get yourself out of the car and go back inside, which I did. And then I fell on the floor and I cried. And I one of those really ugly cries, I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, where just, yeah, everything. And
not
I finally
laughing,
said,
like,
yeah,
on,
I know. And then all of a sudden you just,
yeah.
I just said, this is it. This is enough. I'm going to break my silence and I'm going to talk. So I had started to go to therapy, and through the therapy, I wrote the first book, Surface Tension, which was about my whole experience going to Norway and winning the gold medal and all the things that were happening. And then I was asked to do a TED Talk, and that was the thing that really opened everything up. And that's when I started to stand on stage and start to own what my story was, and to not necessarily own it, I hate that word, but to recognize it and to admit that there was something that was not normal that I went through. Because I really all my life tried so hard to make it normal that this was no different than anyone else's story. Everybody has baggage. I would tell myself these things all the time. And as I started to pursue through therapy and writing is what really helped me. I started meeting other people. And when the book came out, I started getting letters from hockey players, from swimmers, from gymnasts, sharing their stories with me. And they were men. And I realized that there were very few men speaking. And I just decided that I was going to try to do whatever I can to share my story and to help as many people as I can. So I became a board member of the Army of Survivors, which were founded by three gymnasts who were abused by Nassar. And we are now on this journey of trying to show people that they are not alone, especially athletes, and to encourage athletes to speak up. I've had incredible opportunities to speak for the Netflix film Athlete A. I've been on live discussion panels several times with that, and that is rewarding to be able to see how Maggie Nichols, who is the first person who actually spoke up and was the Athlete A against Nassar, and the detriments and all the things that happened that she never even got to go to the Olympics because they removed her. Because the whole U.S. gymnastics didn't want anybody to know about this. So they excluded her from the Olympic Games, and how she has taken this and made it into such a positive that she is now our NC2A national champion in gymnastics. And she's found her love again for the sport. And she's such an inspiration that this young 20-year-old is an inspiration to me now. And to find the strength to go forward and to share the stories. I have done a couple of testimonies. I have testified for the Children of USA and about the economics of elite athletes with other Olympians. And we were able to talk about how the organization of the Olympic organization has been detrimental to athletes and how their economics can lead them into situations such as sexual abuse or even just physical abuse and mental abuse throughout the sport. I've also gave testimony at Maryland for their legislations to extend the statute of limitations so people who are older are able to stand up and say, this happened to me, and we need to have retribution or be able to share the stories. Because children, I mean, at my age of 15, there was no way I was going to stand in front of a jury and tell my story because, one, I was told that they would kill my family if it ever came out. So threats like that were there. This has all been a growing process. It's all started only about 2.5 years ago that I finally broke my silence on the TEDx stage. And it's been a whirlwind. And it's a healing process. Every time I get a chance to speak with you or with anybody, it's peeling back another layer of the onion and finding more things that I need to deal with. So it is a lifelong process. And I really, really encourage people who are listening to find resources and find professional help. You can do it on your own, but it's so much harder because you're having to deal and digest and tear apart things. And I think what happens when we do it on our own is that we lose the perspective of the positiveness of what's going on in our lives and what we can do with our lives. And, you know, being sober for, Bill said, I'm sorry, I'm going to say this wrong, 32, 38 years is an incredible success story. And that should be celebrated. And Peter, your story just broke my heart with the HIV and everything. And, oh, my God, I have such a survivor's guilt because I was going through and saw so many actors and friends who passed away from HIV, and I never understood how I was spared because of what had happened to me. And yet people I knew who only had one encounter, their first encounter, contracted the disease. I was never able to understand or comprehend all that. So those things are all still part of my process of learning and to understand who I am and why am I here. You know, is there a purpose for me being here? Is my story really needed? And I think there is that everybody's story is needed and needs to be told. And so that's basically how are we doing on time?
We've got 13 minutes, so we're doing really
okay.
Well.
So are there any questions? I think that kind of rounds up everything. And if there's questions, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I definitely am going to break back to the panel because we have the time, and I'm sure that there's some questions and comments to what you just stated, which I think was just beautiful.
Thank you.
I think that I think this. You just stated the reason that you're here. I mean, to me.
Thank you.
You just did. And this show is a moment. It's momentous, right? This is a momentous show because we really truly have this this male support and this dialogue. This is going to be archived, and there are going to be so many men that can listen to this show. It's going to help so many people and women and parents and children,
right,
and people trying to understand what this is all about.
Penelope, if you would do me one favor as well, if anybody ever wants to reach out or try to talk with me, please contact you, and you can get in touch with me through Penelope and the group. And that's, I'm happy about that. I'm always open to talk to anyone.
Thank you. Well, we can add you to our contact list on the NASCA website.
Oh, great.
If that's okay.
That'd be wonderful.
Wonderful. Thank you for offering that. We have many NASCA family members that are generous like yourself that are available by phone at any time to talk to other survivors that wish to talk with someone else that can understand. So thank you for that, and I will. And I also sent you a Facebook request. Don't feel any pressure to accept it, seriously, but I did find you because there's a hyperlink here in your bio. So I'm the Penelope that has reached out to you. In case you know, like 10 Penelopes, I'm the one, Penelope Bennett. But I think one other thing I wanted to say before I break to the panel is that when you said, I'm not sure if this is the right word or not, own, when you went on the TED Talk and told your story for the first time, if my memory is serving correctly, that was the first time that you went live with your story. I think own's a great word because I think you command your truth when you mm-hmm. tell it to the world, when you go up on a public forum where the world is there to see it. I think that is truly owning your truth. You can't go back, right? You can't go back after you put
correct,
it out there
correct.
To the public. You
can
you're
go right,
back to
right,
me. You might tell your parents or your therapist or your best friend or whatever, but which is still significant, still very significant
right.
and important part of the healing process. I don't want to minimize that. But I think owning is a great, because you own it and you're certain in it, right? You have
correct,
absolutely
right.
no question. Right.
I think the first thing that needs to be done is you have to recognize it first before you can own it. And I think that's mm-hmm. what I was trying to say. But you're absolutely right. It is an ownership when you
yeah.
finally share it. Thank you for pointing that out.
And the more you share it, the more you realize what, you know what I mean? That you get more, I think it begets itself, right? Because like you said, every time you tell your story, you peel back another layer of the onion. So it
right.
kind of begets itself. All right, well, I'm going to stop talking because I could talk to you forever. I'm so inspired by you. You've inspired me. And like,
well, thank you.
Truly. I'm going to bring Bill back on now. We're at 9 minutes. Bill, you're back on with John.
Thank you. Again, a lot of identification with things like, I'm a frustrated performer. I love to be in front of a group. I'd love to stand on a stage and talk to a group and so forth, anything like that. Just 2 years ago, I joined an improv group for a few months. And, you know, these kinds of things have always attracted me. I've performed music many times, but I haven't done so in years. And, you know, I have to admit, I've never written a book. I've never been on a TED Talk. I've never been in a film that was of any significance, a couple of small things. But, you know, I've never been a star of a daytime soap. I'm jealous, damn it. But I want to admit, to me, this is kind of a character defect in a way that my pride says to me that I should have done something more somehow. And I have a comfortable small house, the result of my editing mostly for sitcoms. I did a lot of comedy in my years, and so forth. But, my life has come to where it is, and it's a really great life. I mean, what I've done instead of a book is I've published the NASCA website, which is a really significant site, and I've formed this group, and I get a lot of kudos for it. But you know what? I'm just passing on what other people gave to me. I am packaging it differently. But I'm not unique in recovery. I'm just Bill. And many people have found it a comfortable place for them to come, practicing whatever recovery process they have is the way to do it. Commend them all. We don't promote any one particular way, and people find that comfortable. I will say just in finality that, I said before that I was brought up extremely Catholic, and I also said before that I learned about the homosexuality issues on the playground. Or maybe I didn't say that, but that's where I learned it. And so I learned terrible stuff. And it was all the way until my first recovery group at age 30 that, I think God has a sort of a sense of timing and comedy that's exquisite, because he got me to Alcoholics Anonymous in Hollywood somehow. And, every third person, let's say, in the room was gay. And I had a big issue about people that were gay, which was incorrect to have, but I had it. And instead of feeling upset about being amongst homosexuals, they began coming over to me as they heard me share and say, we don't want you for your body. We want you for your recovery. And they'd give me a non-sexual type hug and go off. And, it's my prejudice against the whole issue started to melt until today. We recognize, of course, people of every background of every type, whether it's racial or religious or sexual or whatever, every kind of background we believe is appropriate for a person to get into recovery. So we don't make that an issue is the point. And then as far as God is concerned, you may or may not know this, but the 12-step programs are about a relationship with a higher power that gets you the strength to move forward and change really yourself. And so, I was really pissed at God for having, dedicated so much of my life to him and then having been, quote, let down this way. And in AA, I began to, again, melt. The proposition was that I could create my own higher power that was personal to me, that did what I wanted him or her to do and didn't do what I... So I gave up all the punitive side of God. And my God never, from that point on, never threw a lightning bolt, never kept score. I never worried about going to hell. My sins were forgiven the instant I asked for them to be given, and actually before that, they were forgiven. So it's really repaired so much stuff to be in recovery. And as you say, I'm now 38 years in recovery. I'm in my 39th year of recovery, if you want to say it that way. And I don't know what the next year will bring, but living in the next year, I'm living in this moment with this life, and it's wonderful. And they have a terrific group of people who I absolutely never have to question whether they love me or not. Penelope's one of them. Perhaps you are too, John, but I certainly love you. I have a wonderful wife who's a normie, for God's sake, which I never expected to have. She grew up in a nurtured environment. So how can I complain? I can't. I'm more comfortable today than I've ever been before, and I have no reason to believe that won't continue. So again, John, thank you so much for your testimony tonight, your story. We will put you on the contact list, and I'd like to be one of those people that get in touch with you for sure. So appreciate your appearance.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you, Bill. And I just want to say that I think you said that your life isn't important. Your story has blown my mind in what you have done. And I feel the same way, because I feel like when I'm sharing my story, it's not a big deal. So what? It just seems my story. But I think we touch lives in ways that we were not even aware of. So thank you.
That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. It's just that it's, I do have an ego, and the bad part of my ego, tells me I need more proof of success. The good part of my ego says, but you have found a tremendous amount of self-esteem, and that's just the way it is.
Yeah, I like that. That's beautiful.
Wow. How do I follow that? I follow that by bringing Peter back on really fast, because we're at 2 minutes and 40 seconds. So, Peter, I just wanted to bring you on real quick. Maybe you have a word for John. We've got 30 seconds.
Well, I'm not too sure if I do have any contact details with NASCA, but be sure, John, to contact Penelope, and she can give you my information. You got my permission, Penelope, to give him my information. I'll be glad to be in touch with you too, John. So everyone's been amazing tonight. It's just like, my self-esteem right now has just risen. So thank you all, and thank you, John, for sharing your story tonight. And thank you once again, Penelope. You've really blown it up tonight, so you've done very well.
Well, thank you, Peter. I'm glad I did better than my good A, because I'm sure that was a C+. So I'm definitely not an actress. So for what I lacked in my good A today, I hopefully made up in my hosting skills, although I can tell you that it's truly been a privilege. I'm so humbled to have been able to meet John Lander this evening, and to help facilitate, with Bill and with Peter, and with you, John, just you, again, just the courage to tell your story this evening. So thank you so very, very, very much. And to all of you out there listening, please visit www.NASCA, which is NAASCA.org, and God bless the children. Thank you and good night.
Blog Talk Radio.